The operation of the shuttle while you're in orbit, you've got fuel cells and batteries and all kinds of environmental equipment. Is most of that computer controlled, or does it require a little tweaking from time to time?
It's both. We had two types of computer management. One was for guidance, navigation, and control. The other was systems management, and they were on two separate software routines. So if I wanted to do something to control, like turning on or off heaters to a water tank or a helium tank or anything that had to do with plumbing, I could control the heaters, I could control the valves through a computer display with a keyboard. But I could also go to the physical device, and like on my first flight, we had a problem with the toilet. The wastewater
tank. There's a surprise.
And the wastewater tank was not properly prepared before launch. There's a bellows inside of it that as it fills, the bellows compresses, and then when it gets full, we actually would discharge it overboard, and it would create a, literally look like a snowstorm. All that water was going out and instantly freezing and going off into space. And you would get it to go out like that by moving the bellows against the fluid out of valve. The bellows got in there and got cockeyed and wouldn't move.
Oh.
So it filled once and we were done. And so we had to get under the floorboards and get in there and hook up a bunch of bypass plumbing. And we had these contingency storage bags where we could actually collect the wastewater in there and then manually hook that to a port on the side of the ship and get it out overboard that way.
That was fun. You know, but you think about
picture.
It. Long-term spaceflight, you're throwing away a precious resource, and that's water.
Yeah. So on a shuttle flight, you would do that because you had to.
Right. You could.
But on the space station, all of that is recycled today.
Yeah.
Everything is. Very little is not recycled now. It doesn't make it a perpetual motion machine because we humans still consume energy, but the fact that we can take wastewater. Humidity in the atmosphere, the carbon dioxide that we exhale, and take all that back into machinery and recycle it into oxygen or water, or even with carbon dioxide, you can break it down further and you can create methane gas and oxygen, and the methane could be used for fuel.
That's
so
fuel.
There's all kinds of stuff that can be done with the recycling, and you still have to inject energy, but you can preserve a lot of the basic needs. Very well.
You reduce the amount of things you have to bring.
Yeah, and enable you to exploit stuff that's there, like we talked about with water ice and the surface of the moon. And so a lot of those technologies have been perfected on space station. You know, and they're using wastewater and turning it back into good drinking water.
I just hope that we don't trash up the moon like we've done every place else we've ever gone.
If we can keep it as clean as we keep Oshkosh.
Yeah, right. No throwing the coffee cups out the window, okay?
Yeah, I've heard that before. You know, it is just a rock, but...
Yeah. Uh-huh.
But we do need to be careful about confounding our research with our own stuff and confusing...
Contaminating our results.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. It's a very real possibility, considering the confines of space.
Well, you know, when Neil and Buzz came back with Mike... they were in quarantine for quite a while,
right?
Because there was an unknown, and you know, you can kind of poke fun at the docs who didn't really know, but
they had to be.
They were worried
careful.
About them bringing bugs back.
Yep.
You know?
Yeah.
So, I understand they found one on the moon. It was called a lunatic. Yeah.
Yeah.
You've heard that before.
Oh.
Yeah. That's Jeez, old.
That's bad too.
It's as old as Apollo. Well, anyway.
So during space shuttle operation, do you actually have a flight engineer who's keeping an eye on everything, or is that the mission commander and the pilot?
We had a third seat that we called the mission specialist number two, and that was a role I played on my first flight, and that is considered the flight engineer. So when you think of a three-seat operation in a traditional commercial aircraft, that middle seat was our flight engineer. So what we had was with a complex suite of systems that had to be operated, the commander seat managed the computer systems, the main access to the computer software routines and so forth, guidance, navigation, control, the backup software. He also had the general navigation and piloting responsibility. He had the environmental control system on panels to his left. The pilot had control of the engines, the thrusters, and the auxiliary power units and the electrical power systems and the cryo, what we call the cryo systems, the liquid hydrogen and oxygen that would feed the fuel cells to create electricity. That was all on his side, and overhead we had circuit breakers for everything, and the flight engineer sat in the middle and played symphony orchestra conductor between the two, because a lot of those systems are integrated, right? And so I can't be working on a computer as the commander where I'm changing computer software code and not affect the pilot who's trying to start an APU, for instance, right? So I'm giving you a generalization here, but the flight engineer was responsible for keeping us coordinated, and the commander overall would call the shots on, you know, key milestone decisions that need to be made in the flow of a phase of flight and so forth.
Now, during launch and all the way to orbit, it's all computer guided. You're not really hand flying.
We can hand fly it. We don't. We don't want to hand fly in the first 30-ish seconds. I can't remember exactly the timeline, but there is a point in time where manual inputs could overstress the vehicle. Very, very small, because the computers are anticipating changes in winds that we have forecasted based on balloon data before we fly, and so there is a routine that anticipates shear in the wind as we're going up, and it actually lead turns into the wind as we get there. And the human can't see that coming, so we could actually cause an overstress situation. So until you're above the place, you know, 45, 50, 60,000 feet, you don't want to be hand flying it because you could overstress it. But after that, you can hand fly it all the way to orbit. We choose not to because it's a lot to manage, and we have to monitor an awful lot with trajectory and systems and so forth. It's the same on reentry. Joe Engel, who will be with us tonight, is the only one to have hand flown all the way down from orbit to touchdown.
Wow.
And that was to validate the trajectories that we were going to use and the software to control the shuttle. So on the second flight of the shuttle, he did that, and that helped us validate the way we were programming the reentry.
That's quite a job.
Usually we would just take over at about Mach 1, and we'd about 50,000 feet, 40,000 feet-ish, and we would fly that last alignment turn to get onto the runway heading all the way to touchdown. That was all done manually. And the dockings were all done manually from about the last hour to contact into the contact point. That was all done manually as well.
Wow.
What about liftoff? That's got to be exciting when, you know, the main engines fire up and then the SRBs light up and you're gone.
Exactly.
Is it quite a rush when that happens?
It is. Just picture the chair you're sitting in, tip it over on its back, and you on your back looking up at the ceiling, and it's as if this giant hand reaches in under the chair and lurches you through the ceiling. And that initial push doesn't go away. You know, we've all remember a friend of ours in the hallways at school coming up behind us and pushing us in the back, and you get that push, right? Well, that's an instantaneous acceleration. Well, this is continuous for 8.5 minutes. It never stops pushing you, so it's squeezing you against the back of your seat. And as we burn fuel off, the thrust is the same, but the fuel weight is gone, and so the thrust-to-weight ratio is increasing,
right,
which is effectively the G-force you feel. So we're about 1.5 Gs, or 1.25 to 1.5 Gs in the early phase, and then as the boosters burn out, we're up close to 2.5 Gs, and the boosters burn out and go away, and the thrust drops. And so now we drop back to 1.25, 1.5 Gs, and then by the time we get to orbit, we're pulling about 3 Gs, squeezing your chest into the back of your seat. You feel like there's a gorilla sitting on your chest. It gets hard to breathe.
Yeah.
And so that whole phase is pretty impressive.
When you have SRB separation, is there a vibration that you feel in the craft?
You feel a kind of a thump, yeah, and you can hear the
and the little
separation.
Computer voice goes, there they go.
Yeah. Bye-bye.
Yeah.
Wow.
Sounds like a great experience. When can we go on
that? Yeah, exactly. A little too late. Yeah. Daylight dollar short there, buddy.
Well, that's okay. Fortunately, there is video on YouTube of
exactly.
all of this stuff going on.
Exactly.
And it looks to me like every now and then the shuttle astronauts as well as space station astronauts, they have a little bit of free time to have just a little bit of fun.
Exactly.
Okay, Charlie, I want to thank you. We've taken up way too much of your time.
Been fun.
It has been fun, and we could go another 6 hours if you let us.
Easily.
You bet.
Anyway, this is Digital Dave.
And I'm Fast Eddie.
And this is EAA Radio.